This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Tuesday, July 26, 2016. I'm Caleb Brown. The most subversive part of Bitcoin may well be the underlying blockchain technology. That's the argument from Don and Alex Tapscott, authors of the new book, Blockchain Revolution. We spoke last month.
A few years ago, everybody seemed really excited about Bitcoin, which was not just a virtual currency, but a ledger, and it had all these neat features built into it. But blockchain seems to be the thing that a lot of financial firms are really excited about now, and other groups of people who want to use sort of trustless business innovation. So describe for the general public, what is blockchain technology?
Well, I'll get started. This is Alex Tapscott. We've been researching this subject for the better part of 2 years and have basically become convinced that blockchain represents nothing less than the second generation of the internet. And as a result, we think it's going to have a really powerful impact on industries like financial services, but also on the economy as a whole, potentially on government and society. So when you use the internet today to send or move or share information, you're not actually sending an original. You're sending a copy. And generally speaking, that's okay. In fact, it's a good thing in certain situations. It means we can share information with people. And in many respects, we have a printing press for information. When it comes to things of value like money or stocks or bonds or other financial assets, sending a copy is a really bad idea. If I give you $100 for something, it's really important that you know that you have it and I don't. Because if I can send the same $100 to Don here to my right or to anybody else, that $100 becomes worthless. So as a result, we need to rely on these trusted intermediaries to verify the identity of parties, to create trust, and also to do all the processing and clearing and record keeping that's required in commerce online. And these intermediaries do an okay job, but with some limitations. They're centralized, and anything centralized is vulnerable to attack or failure. They capture our data, which potentially could undermine our privacy and our rights. They tax the system. In the case of sending money overseas, it costs 10% or more. They exclude billions of people from the global economy who don't have access to banking, who don't have access to identity. they slow things down. It turns out that the back-end processes for a lot of financial parts of the financial services industry are quite out of date, running on old technology. So in sum, we'd argue that they capture an asymmetric amount of the value, undermining the individual's ability to monetize it and get their fair share. So with blockchain, we have a vast new global platform that's based on this distributed ledger, this database of everything that's occurred, that's running on millions of computers around the world and open to anyone. We're not just information, but anything of value, money, financial assets, but also things like titles and deeds, identity, companies, intellectual property, even things like votes can be managed, moved, and stored securely and privately. And where trust is not established by a third party like a government or a bank, but rather through mass collaboration and clever code. And as a result, we think that's going to have a really big impact on a lot of things.
Indeed. And most people think about Bitcoin initially as an asset. You know, it goes up or down in value. It's something broader. It's a cryptocurrency, which is not created or controlled by nation states. And that gets more interesting. But the most important thing is that the underlying technology, the blockchain, is, we think, the biggest innovation in computer science in a generation. And it holds the potential to create a very different kind of, not just bank or financial services institution, but a very different kind of corporation, a very different kind of government, and a very different kind of society.
In terms of somebody who wants to access the broad market of equities, what are the costs that they are have to absorb right now that they will not have to absorb with a broad distribution of blockchain technology?
Well, it's an interesting example because when it comes to equity trading today, the hot new thing that people talk about is high-frequency traders, where competitive advantage is measured in nanoseconds.
Where you actually get a a technical advantage over your competitors.
That's
by
right.
being physically closer to the trading floor, because your bits don't have to travel as far of a physical distance.
Exactly.
And that can actually make a difference.
My favorite example is the group of investors that built a fiber optic cable from Chicago to New York, from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange to the New York Stock Exchange, and carved through granite mountains to cut, you know, a couple kilometers off the distance. But the back end of the equity market is similar for a lot of people. So, you know, you may confer competitive advantage in a few nanoseconds, but it still takes T plus three, so it takes 2 to 3 days to settle that trade. It's the same for the, you know, mom-and-pop investor living in Idaho on the farm, which is kind of bizarre. And that's actually true, broadly speaking, of a lot of parts of the financial services industry, where the front end may seem seamless. You know, you tap your card at Starbucks and you think the payment stream is going right to the merchant. It's not. It's going through this huge network of intermediaries. And that puts cost on the system. So in the case of equity trading, you've got clearing and settling and back office costs that are, you know, the burden of the system usually falls on the individual. And that's where you get, you know, the commission structure on trading in securities. So I think more so than cost, you've also got the risk issue, which is less of an issue with public equities, but broadly speaking, an issue with lots of financial securities, where you might have counterparty risk or settlement risk of things just bouncing. Trades just don't actually go through. So if we can reduce cost and risk and increase speed and efficiency, financial markets, then individual investors will benefit directly from that.
Compare to me the benefits for a small investor or a small business person and a large investor. It seems intuitive to me that if this kind of technology is available broadly, that the benefits would accrue to people who have less to invest. That is the cost of getting into the game yeah. is not quite as high relatively for somebody with smaller amounts of money to invest. Is that true?
Well, I'll start with investors in the sense of entrepreneurs. So the way that we've created wealth throughout the last century is largely through vertically integrated corporations that do everything from soup to nuts. And what we believe blockchain technology will do is radically drop transaction and collaboration costs in the economy. And that's going to enable small companies to have the capabilities of big companies without the main liabilities, deadening bureaucracy, legacy systems, a culture, and people, and so on. And it's possible to imagine a corporation that has a million investors as a startup, where it's essentially a crowdfunding model, and people are not buying an early copy of a Pebble watch or something like that. They're buying equity in the company. And with blockchains, this technology could enable radical new models of the firm. Now, in the book, for example, we hypothesized about something we called the distributed autonomous enterprise. And this is a corporation where a large number of investors provided the initial capital, but the company could really run pretty much without people. It could be software running on a blockchain. And this is all possible because of things like smart contracts, just what it sounds like, contracts that manage digital assets, self-execute, and have a bank account, but also through intelligent agents working on a blockchain. So Alex and I had a good chat about this. Do we really want to publish something that's so kind of wacky and far out, a people-less company? Totally coincidentally, the day the book came out, the second week in May, an organization called the Distributed Autonomous Organization was announced. And it had no people, no management, no CEO. It had a bunch of software, and its first job was to go raise some money. And it went out and raised $150 million. And so it was like this crazy, wacky idea that turned into reality way faster than we thought it might.
So you were talking about it in theory, and while you were talking about it, it happened in practice?
Yeah.
We swear we didn't plan it that way, but
It was kind of good for book sales because now everybody's buzzing about this distributed autonomous organization.
Yeah.
We're the ones who invented the idea.
Yeah,
pretty much.
Defined it in
so,
the book. Yeah.
So let's get real. Let's get down to the nuts and bolts here for this kind of company that operates in essence without people. What does that mean that it operates without people? You're talking. I'm thinking of companies that have HR departments and have debate over what their corporate strategy is going to be and things like that. So in terms of that kind of stuff, what are we talking about?
Well, to be clear, we're not arguing that the firm of the future won't have people involved in it. But it turns out that a lot of the functions of what companies do can be automated using this technology, and that can create a lot of really positive benefits. An example of which is that today we have this issue with the principal agent problem, where you've got managers who are hired by stakeholders to run a business, and oftentimes their interests don't align with shareholders' rights. And that creates all sorts of problems. And it's sort of an example of the moral hazard issue where, you know, someone takes undue risk because if they're right, then they'll get paid off big time. And if they're wrong, someone else will pick up the tab, essentially. And this has been an issue for behavioral economists and regulators and shareholder rights activists for a long time. How do we untangle these issues? So could we organize a business where we could disintermediate human frailty, not human beings, but these issues that create problems inside businesses, and still enable people to do what people do best, strategize, innovate, think, and be creative. So that's the, if someone can find the right balance between streamlining and automating these kinds of things inside a firm whilst still enabling people to do what they do best, I think that's the model for the firm of the future.
So essentially cutting out a lot of the overhead associated with any given business.
And enterprise. We speak specifically as well to many of those different functions like HR and sales and other components of the firm as well in the book.
Well, the really big one on our mind is a broader kind of social thing. And it has to do with prosperity, that we have all this miraculous technology, but for the first time in modern history, the 51st percentile individual or family is not getting ahead. And social inequality has become this big public policy issue, and the only approach that anyone's come up with to solve it is to have bigger taxes, including on the rich, focused on the rich. And by doing that, we can redistribute wealth. Well, what we argue in the book is that there may be a completely different approach, that we can pre-distribute wealth in the sense of democratizing how wealth gets created through this technology. So, and there are a lot of ways to do that. We can bring billions of people into the global economy who don't have a bank account because they don't have an identity or enough money through technology. Not through big financial institutions or governments. We can solve the problem of land titles, ensuring that people have a real right to their land. 70% of people who own land in the world have a flaky title, and you may be living in Honduras and you got a little piece of land and some dictator comes to power and says, I know you got a piece of paper saying you own your land, but our government computers say that my friend owns your land. This is a huge problem. That really happened in Honduras. So by putting land titles on a blockchain, no dictator can mess with them. We could create a sort of halcyon age of entrepreneurship through this technology. We can ensure that people's economic rights are protected. Just an example right now, and we talk about this a fair bit in the book, is how musicians get screwed. They create this value, but they don't get to keep much of it. And it has always been such, at least since the record labels gained a hammer lock on the music industry. And then along came the technology companies like Apple, and then the streaming companies like Spotify, and the musicians are left with crumbs. So right now, today, the Grammy-winning singer-songwriter Imogen Heap is creating a new platform for the music industry where musicians post their music on this blockchain platform along with some smart contracts that specify all the IP rights. And if you listen to the song, maybe a few microcents go to her account. If you put the song in a movie, then that's different. The smart contract specifies all the rights. If you remix the song, there are different rights. Mm-hmm. And this can enable musicians to get fed first. And it's the severity of the situation from a big social point of view is quite extreme. It's not just musicians. It's all kinds of people who create value. The head of the Songwriters Association of Canada did some math on this, and he said, if I wrote a hit song 20 years ago and it sold a million singles, I'd make $45,000. If I write a hit song today and it gets a million downloads, I don't get $45,000. I get $36, which won't even get me to the airport. Might get you a nice pizza or something rather than an annual living. So there are many injustices like this that can be fixed by people self-organizing using this technology rather than through big, powerful institutions.
Talking about crowdfunding as a method of using blockchain to, as you say, democratize wealth and the creation of it, there are a lot of regulators who would be perfectly happy to say, oh, no, this is not something that is allowed, and a lot of business people find themselves when they've requested all their friends and family to chip in for a business, they find out that they are subject to Securities and Exchange Commission regulations regarding public offerings.
Yeah, it's kind of always been that way when you get a big new technology innovation.
The question then is, to what extent does blockchain sort of challenge the regulatory models that currently exist and how regulators go about doing their jobs every day?
It's going to fundamentally transform the role of regulators in ways that might be expected and others that are unexpected. The rules that govern the financial services industry are a bit of a hodgepodge, and some of them date back to the 19th century in many respects. In fact, money transmission laws in New York predate the telegraph, and so where the primary source of sending and receiving funds was horse and buggy. And so laws like that could never have envisioned ACH, the automated clearinghouse, let alone the internet or something as advanced as blockchain technology. Where we see this technology intersecting with regulators, though, is that we believe that blockchain could be a powerful tool for different stakeholders in the industry to do their jobs better. I think it's clear that for financial services institutions and for the individual investor and the individual participant, things will improve dramatically. But regulators, too, can benefit because when transactions are done using blockchain, the record of them appears on this distributed ledger, which everyone can see. And so if a regulator has the ability to see in real time what is going on inside the financial services industry, then they don't need to dig into individual companies' annual reports or into their specific financial records because what's occurred is there for all to see. So it's our hope that regulators will take an enlightened approach to this and see the benefit to them, and actually, rather than increasing the regulatory burden on firms, perhaps even pull some back because you've got greater transparency and responsiveness.
Well, wish in one hand, as they say.
Yeah.
What you're describing then is essentially people using this technology, maybe building their own models about what the real status of a particular company might be, getting a real-time assessment of the solvency and profitability and risks associated with decisions that various firms make the time.
It's sort of the idea that sunlight is a great disinfectant. And we've actually been talking about the idea of a citizen regulator. That through transparency, for example, triple entry accounting, people can see what's occurring. And we argue that when it comes to regulating digital currencies and blockchain technology and so on, that a light approach and a cautious approach makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the early days of the internet, there was a proposal in Congress that everyone who created a website would have to have a CB license, CB radio license. I think there were like 300 or 400 of them in the world at the time. And regulators, initially we were quite concerned because there was a lot of fear and uncertainty about this technology. But overall, I think that the smart ones are understanding that this could be good for the economy and that they shouldn't crush it in the egg.
Mm-hmm. Well, based on regulation, you said that it might help regulators. That's not going to be any comfort to people listening to this podcast. But
Help them in the sense of being able to be comfortable that things are working well in society without having a heavy hand and increasing the regulatory burden.
Again, probably not of much comfort to a lot of listeners. So let me ask a question related to that. You were talking about the ability to do things privately. Mm-hmm. And there are a number of projects that are out there making use of blockchain technology to essentially shield both sides of a transaction. Mm-hmm. And what do you think of that?
We talk about Don talked about transparency, and it's the what we view as sort of the great two-sided debate about this whole thing, which is that could you have a technology that increases transparency for institutions and increases accountability for governments, corporations, while also enabling privacy for individuals? And we think that that's possible with this technology. Now, I'm not sure what specifically you're referring to, but there are implementations of blockchain that enable completely trustless, anonymous transactions. And I think there are lots of examples where that's desirable. Maybe you don't want anyone to know a specific social cause that you are supporting. Maybe you're living in a part of the world where the government is authoritarian and you want to be able to make payments and start a business without them cracking down on you. Maybe you want to read a newspaper without the threat of someone knocking on your door and arresting you for, you know, breaking some arbitrary law. So, of course, there are lots of examples. I can imagine a Saudi woman wants to start an online blog and not having to worry about being reprimanded by some moral police force, right? So I think that privacy for the individual and transparency at the institutional level, if achievable, is the most desirable outcome.
The opportunity here for privacy is quite profound. And we polemicize in the book against those who say privacy is dead, get over it. Privacy is the foundation of a free society, and we all need to protect our identity and in fact, to manage it in a responsible way. And it's one of the great ironies of the first era of the Internet of Information, that we, all of us, create this data, arguably the biggest asset ever, a new asset class. But somebody else owns it. And it's owned by big companies. It's owned by big governments. And they get all kinds of asymmetrical benefit for them as a result of that. So for corporations, they can monetize that data. And we're denied that opportunity, but we're also denied the right to use that data to help us better run our lives. And what does it mean for a corporation to have perfect information about each of us? And it's no surprise, I'm sure, and no revelation to the listeners of this particular podcast that all around the world, the governments are creating a surveillance society. And people who, assume that governments are benevolent are naive, to say the least. So the opportunity here is that we could get our identity back. You know, the virtual Alex may know more about Alex than he does in certain areas because he can't remember what he said a year ago or bought a year ago or his specific location at this instant a year ago. What if Alex could get control of the virtual Alex? And that's the opportunity here, that we can each have an avatar, which is our own identity, that we can manage. And that identity travels around in the digital age with us, and it gives out that shred of information required to do a transaction or to do whatever. And in many situations, you don't have to give out any information. I mean, if you sell me something, what you really care about is that you get paid. You don't even need to know who I am. And you sure don't need to know what my frequent flyer number is and what my social insurance number is and what my driver's license is and all the rest of the stuff that's become aggregated together into these bundled identities that we have today. So this is one of the biggest opportunities, because this is the foundation of freedom. And it's been undermined seriously through the first generation of the internet. We can get it back.
Don and Alex Tapscott are authors of Blockchain Revolution. Subscribe to this podcast at iTunes, Google Play, and with Cato's iOS app. And follow us on Twitter at Cato Podcast.